We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Good morning. Welcome to Focus. This is our morning talk program. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. Well, if you want to have an optimally functioning country, a place with stability, prosperity, peace, the kind of place where most people would say they would want to live, what do you need? Our guest for this hour, Francis Fukuyama, makes the argument that basically you need three things. Certainly you need to have a state with a centralized source of authority. But perhaps more important, that authority has to be subject to rule of law, and it has to be accountable to its citizens. Now, if you look around the world, you look through world history, you can actually find places that have some of these things. You can find places that have all of them. But having all of them actually seems to be a little rare, which leads to the question, why is it they have any of them at all? It was that question that he was thinking about, had been thinking about for quite a long time, and that he writes about in his recent book that's titled The Origins of Political Order from Pre-Human Times to the French Revolution, and is intended to be the first volume in a series that will bring us up to the present day. The book has gotten a lot of attention. He has some interesting things to say, and we're pleased that he could be with us to outline the basic argument that he makes in the book, which is published by Farrar, Straus, and Giroux. It's just out. Francis Fukuyama is the Olivier Nomellini Senior Fellow at Stanford University's Freeman Spogli Institute for International Studies. Before being there at Stanford, he taught at the Paul Nitze School of Advanced International Studies of Johns Hopkins University and at the George Mason University School of Public Policy. He's joining us this morning by telephone. And as we talk, questions are certainly welcome. We hope that people will be on target, please, with the topic, and also be as brief as you can. That way we can get in as many callers as possible, keep things moving along. But questions are welcome. 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana. Toll free, 800-222-9455. And the email is WILL hyphen, I've been saying dash, I guess that's wrong. It's will-illinois.edu. So if you can find your way to the email site, we'd be very happy to take your thoughts that way. And Dr. Fukuyama, hello.
Good morning.
Thank you very much for talking with us today.
Well, thanks for having me on.
Well, I think it's quite an interesting and rather involved argument that you make in this book, and I hope that at least we can sketch out the basics. People want to explore it in greater depth. They can seek out the book, which is out now. To start, we need to, at least for a moment here, go rather far back in human history with the basic point that you make, and not just you, but other anthropologists and sociologists make, that human beings early on started to organize themselves into groups. It wasn't just a free-for-all, everybody out for himself or herself. People organized themselves into groups, and the thing around which they organized, maybe not surprising, was family, in a sense. People lined up according to who was related to them, and saw their interests in common and fought to protect those interests. And that's the place where we start in this whole business of building up states.
Yes, that's right. I think particularly here in the United States, we have this individualistic notion that we all somehow started as these isolated individuals, and we only, as a result of historical progress, came together in society. But in fact, higher primates organize themselves into what look like political groups. You know, chimpanzees form gangs and fight each other just the way human beings do. And I think in early human development, there were two principles that allowed people to work together. One was the principle of family, that we're altruistic towards genetic relatives. This is the principle of nepotism. And then the other principle is what the biologists call reciprocal altruism, which is the exchange of favors with friends. And so friends and family are kind of a default mode of human social organization. It exists in every single society, regardless of culture, and it's a form of social organization that we default to in the absence of incentives to be loyal to, you know, higher, more developed forms of organization like a state or you know, a democratic society. So in a sense, the problem of creating political order has to be seen against the background of family and this natural biological urge that we have to do things simply on the basis of friends and family.
Mm. And that the argument then from that point is, well, you can start that way, but for reasons of understandable reasons of security, you realize that these kinds of groups then have to start affiliating with one another, strength in numbers. So that's how it is that you can go from a family-oriented group to a tribe, and then you can get larger and larger groups.
That's right. That's right. You know, I mean, one of the tragic aspects of human social progress, in a sense, is the fact that a lot of it is really driven by the need for security and you know, frankly, war, that these higher-level groups, because they can organize a bigger scale, you know, fighting forces tend to either conquer or intimidate the ones that are less socially organized. And so the first big transition is from a kind of family or band level hunter-gatherer societies to tribal societies in which people trace ancestry to a common ancestor that may be dead three or four generations ago. And then, you know, that allows you to scale up to social groups that have hundreds or even thousands of people. And then the state is, you know, the next level up from that, because the state has a centralized a coercive apparatus, you know, police and army that can keep order, enforce laws. And generally speaking, each of these higher levels of organization can beat the ones below them. And that's why there's this constant pressure over the course of human history to move to these more complex forms of organization.
Mm-hmm. Well, what's I think here interesting is that your argument is then to make the leap to the kind of modern state that we're talking about, and you identify the Qin of ancient China as being the first. I know some people might want to argue about that, but in any case, the first to have a state like that, the thing that you really have to overcome, in fact, is this inborn tendency we have to affiliate with family, to want to do favors for our family and our friends to the exclusion of other people's families, and that to have this kind of state, to have a functioning professional bureaucracy, for example, what you have to do is you have to break that.
That's right. That's right. Well, you know, favoring friends and family is not exactly unknown in modern-day America. And, you know, it's really the source of corruption in political organization, because, as I said, this is a kind of natural thing that we do without having to be instructed by anyone. And in some respects, the creation of modern politics is the creation of a institution that will deal with people uniformly on the basis of their simply being citizens and not just being the cousin or the brother-in-law of whoever is in power. I mean, you see this in a place like Egypt, where Hosni Mubarak, who was just forced out of office as president, basically enriched himself and his family in this kind of corrupt empire. And that's really what people resent, is the fact that he's brought this patrimonial form of politics into what should be an impersonal modern administration. And as you said, you know, the struggle against the family, the struggle to create impersonal institutions really dates back a couple of millennia. I argued that it's really the Chinese in the 3rd century BC that were the first society. They weren't the first society to create a state, because that had existed in Egypt and Mesopotamia and a lot of other places earlier than that. But they were the first ones to actually create a modern bureaucracy in which people were recruited on the basis of talents and not just who they were related to. They invented the civil service examination. And this is all, you know, a very impressive effort to get away from the family that was in place in the year 221 BC.
Hmm. I do think it seems, at least from my grasp of world history, that that's correct, that it was the Chinese who invented the idea of this bureaucratic meritocracy that the state that organized the state. Now, though, I think, as you point out, you can find functioning states that are still largely organized around this idea of family, friends, patronage, and so forth. Now, they may not be optimally functioning. There's not going to be the levels of equality I think we'd like to see. There are states that are held together by force, but but they exist. So that still, it still gets to this question, well, why is it that that this other kind of state should exist at all? Mm-hmm. And why do you think that China was the place, since we're all, you know, so many people here, I think, in the West, as we study the history of politics, we think the origins of political order are in Greece. And so to say that it started at all and started in China, it seems sort of a departure from the mm-hmm. way that we're used to thinking about this.
No, that's right. I mean, I think that obviously the Greeks and Romans developed very sophisticated political institutions, particularly the Greeks with democracy and the Romans with law. But in terms of modern public administration, meaning a bureaucracy recruited on the basis of talent, I think that the Chinese really had it all over the Greeks and Romans. And again, it was, in a sense, tragically driven by war. The Chinese fought incessantly over a 500-year period, these two historical periods they call the Spring and Autumn and Warring States periods in Chinese history, from about the 7th to the 3rd centuries B.C., and just as in early modern Europe, it was this need to fight war, to induct peasants into an army, to raise taxes in order to pay them and to provision these armies, that you needed a bureaucracy in the crucible of war. If you don't hire the most competent general, you're going to lose. And so the principle of meritocracy, in a sense, gets enshrined. And it's something that later countries have had to learn very painfully. The United States had a patronage system at the beginning of the Civil War. A lot of Abraham Lincoln's early appointments as generals were incompetent politicians. Again, this friends and family principle. And it was only after several very painful Union losses that that he started appointing people on the basis of military merit. And that's something that the Chinese had figured out a couple of millennia earlier.
Well, good. Just returning to the question, as you pointed out, there are other examples of highly organized states with centralized authority before the Qin, but that the kind of state that you're talking about, organized as it is, seems to begin with them. So then we come back to this question, well, why them, and why in that place and why at that time?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think there you probably have to go back to factors like simple geography, that Chinese civilization, like many other civilizations, begins around a river valley. It's fertile because you have alluvial irrigation, but it's also a large area. This is the Yellow River Valley that then later expands into the Yangtze River Valley a little bit to the south. It can support a very large scale of civilization. It's highly productive, so you get surpluses that allow the state to grow. And then one of the critical differences between China and Europe is the fact that there really aren't competing power centers, or power doesn't get divided by big rivers and mountain ranges and, the sorts of physical features that exist in, particularly in Western Europe, except for these barbarians that live out on the Central Asian plains that, become a constant source of harassment to the Chinese, but not a major, power that threatens them the way European states were able to be threatened. And that's really the basis for the early consolidation of a Chinese state that led to, their perfection in a sense of dictatorship at a very early point in their history.
And certainly, here again, if the things that are important are not only centralized authority but also rule of law, to which the ruler is subject, to which everyone is subject, including the ruler, and some kind of accountability to the citizenry, if those are the essential elements, and also I think you make the argument that it's important that those things, not just that they all happen, but they all happen in a certain order. That at least as far as China is concerned, you can say, yes, there was a centralized hierarchical source of authority, but as far as rule of law and accountability is concerned, the emperor was law unto himself, and he could essentially do whatever he wanted.
That's right. Well, I think that rule of law in the deepest sense means constraints on executive power, that the ruler doesn't make up the laws as he goes along, that he has to basically execute laws that are made by somebody else, that are made by the larger community. And in most world civilizations, that law has come out of religion. That's true in ancient Israel. It's true in the Christian West. It's true in the world of Islam. And it's been true in Hindu India. All of these places had religious establishments that made law, and rulers believed that they were subject to that law. The only, I think the only world civilization that never had rule of law in that sense was China. And I think the reason was that the Chinese never developed a transcendental religion that would place law outside of the, you know, the as you said, the will of the emperor. And so, you know, in a sense, that tempers our admiration for this Chinese achievement in the 3rd century B.C., because if you develop a modern, centralized, bureaucratic state without rule of law and without political accountability, then what you've done is establish a more perfect dictatorship. And that's really been, in a sense, a very long-term Chinese legacy. I think now they're struggling with the need to create these kinds of institutions, particularly for the sake of economic growth, because you need property rights and you need these kinds of legal constraints in a modern economic system. But this is something that's not deeply embedded in their tradition the way it is in other world civilizations.
Mm. I wonder, just one other thing, that this is maybe a little bit of a side point, but I as I always remember reading about and studying about Chinese history, about the development of Confucian thought and a Confucian worldview, the thing that I always was taught was that the thing about this was that in that system, the state was the family writ large, and in a sense that this idea of the family being a basic organizational principle was something that I'm not sure that the Chinese ever really moved beyond. In some fundamental way.
Well, that's true in, I think, a moral sense, that there's a sense of paternalism that acts as a kind of moral constraint on rulers. So Chinese rulers are supposed to exercise the virtue of benevolence towards their subjects. So there's no formal democratic accountability in the Chinese tradition, nothing like elections or the formal subjecting of rulers to accountability. But there is something like moral accountability of the sort that you'd have within a family or between a father and his children. And I think it's actually had an important impact on the development of modern Chinese societies. If you think about where all of the good dictatorships are, and by good I mean ones that actually have presided over rapid economic growth that led to the increasing prosperity of the whole society, they all tend to be clustered in East Asia. There are places like, Korea and Taiwan under dictatorships in the last couple of generations, China itself, Singapore. All of these places, I think, were influenced by this Chinese tradition, of modernizing authoritarian rule that was, in a certain sense, developmentally oriented in a way that many dictatorships in Sub-Saharan Africa or Latin America or the Middle East simply were not.
The guest in this hour of Focus, Francis Fukuyama, and we're talking about his new book. It's titled The Origins of Political Order, From Pre-Human Times to the French Revolution. It's published by Farrar, Straus, and Giroux. The book is just out recently. Just a quick mention here that we are following some potential for severe weather in our area and that we have a tornado watch that remains in effect until 1 o'clock this afternoon. Our county, Champaign, is included, as well as Coles, DeWitt, Vermilion, Douglas, Macon, Ford, Moultrie, and Piatt in our severe weather coverage area. There are a lot of other counties included as well, but those in our severe weather coverage area are included. So just keep in mind that there is the possibility this morning for some severe weather, and we will do our best to keep you informed of the weather as it develops. We also are happy to have questions here, 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana. We have a toll-free line that's good anywhere that you can hear us. That is 800-222-9455 here locally, 333-9455. And if you'd like to send us an email, it's will, W-I-L-L, hyphen, illinois.edu. And our guest for this hour of the show is Francis Fukuyama. Well, and moving on to talk about how it is these other things develop. The sort of the next thing, if you make this argument that things have to develop in a certain way, and that the next important thing is rule of law, where, and particularly this is something that we do now start to see developing in medieval Europe, not in China, but in medieval Europe, then the question is, well, what was going on there? And the, as you have already argued, in a sense, the conditions on the ground were a little bit different, but there were different institutions operating there. And in fact, you make this argument that as far as development of rule of law is concerned, that the church, the Catholic Church, was the important factor.
Yes, that's right. Well, in general, I think rule of law as a set of constraints on executive authority really has tended to come out of religion, whether that's Hinduism or Islam or Christianity. In the West, the Catholic Church, way back in the 11th century, had a big showdown with secular authorities, with the Holy Roman Emperor. There was a great pope, Gregory VII, who, first of all, wanted to clean up the Church's own act, so he campaigned for celibacy of the priesthood. I think a lot of modern Catholics don't understand that the celibacy of the priesthood is not a doctrinal issue in the Church so much as a pragmatic one, that you know, at that time, priests and bishops were allowed to marry and have children, and naturally, what did they want to do? They wanted to pass on their benefices to their children, and so they got involved in court politics, and the church itself seemed like a highly corrupt institution, and so celibacy of the priesthood was a rallying cry, and also independence of the church from secular authorities, and so this led to a huge two-generation-long war between the papacy and a lot of the princes in Italy and Germany at the time, known as the investiture conflict. And as a result of this effort to create a kind of moral legitimacy for the church resurrected the 6th century compilation of Roman law known as the Justinian Code. They began to teach it in the law school at the University of Bologna, which then seeded law schools all over the rest of Europe. And already by the beginning of the 12th century, Europe had a transnational rule of law based on this resurrected Roman law that was the background. You know, so already in the Middle Ages, you had a strong sense of law. And then, you know, when you get to the early modern period in the 16th, 17th centuries, when a lot of European monarchs like Louis XIV want to behave like Chinese emperors and create these strong centralized states, they have to do that against the background of existing legal constraints on their authority. And so, you know, this is, I think, important because it should, in a way, temper our view of rule of law in contemporary developing societies, because rule of law in the West came very, very early in the history of European development. It happened before the consolidation of states, and it acted as a constraint on state consolidation. Unfortunately, what happens in many developing countries is that rule of law is kind of an afterthought, that you already develop a strong state, as in China, and then you want to try to figure out, well, how do we constrain it by adding rule of law later, without this recognition that, you know, the sequence in Europe was really quite different.
Mm. I do think this is quite fascinating to me. I can certainly understand the church, the Roman Catholic Church, being interested in being an independent, having an independent power base, and that is not having, for example, the emperor, the Holy Roman Emperor, be able to appoint bishops, which was one of their issues. They wanted to be independent of secular authority. But I do think it's quite interesting that you'd make this argument that says actually also the idea of celibacy. It really helps in the sense that if you're a priest or a bishop or the pope or whoever, you don't have children, you can't pass the position on to your son.
Right, right. Well, this is, again, this universal desire that people have, and particularly, you know, wealthy, powerful elites, they want to pass on that elite status to their children. And so this happened within the church. You know, it happened within the Chinese hierarchy, which is why they established a meritocratic civil service exam, and it happens, you know, in every single society that doesn't create institutions to select people on the basis of merit and talent rather than simply bloodlines.
We have a caller here. Let's get him into the conversation. Somebody on a cell phone, and they're on our line one. Hello.
Hello. Hi. You talked about how the sort of Chinese model of strong central government without explicit rule of law influenced a lot of the countries in that region. I was wondering if you could talk about Japan specifically and how, you know, how China's influenced it and how that affects the current state of Japanese democracy.
Well, by the time you get to Japanese development, there's a lot of other influences as well. So they begin, you know, with this heavy influence of Confucian bureaucracy. So the Japanese start with a strong state. But unlike China, it's not a unified empire. It's up until the opening by Commodore Perry in the 1850s, they'd been a kind of closed feudal society with distributed power. And when they open themselves up, they're looking for a foreign model. They go to the British Constitution. They decide that's a little bit too liberal. And then they end up choosing the German system that reserved powers for the emperor that they had just resurrected as an institution. And that's kind of the legal model that they adopt from the West as they modernize in the late 19th and early 20th centuries. It gets them into a lot of trouble because the one thing that the German Constitution does, the Bismarck Constitution, is it gives the emperor authority over the military. And then as you get into the 1930s, the military starts controlling the emperor rather than the other way around. And that, you know, that's the road that then leads them into the Pacific War and Pearl Harbor and the war with the United States. And so the thing that they get from China, I think, is a good, capable, technocratic bureaucracy. That's really the Chinese legacy. And then they've layered on top of that these legal borrowings from the West, and that, you know, I think gives you the current Japanese system.
I don't. Is the caller still? Did I get at your question?
Yeah. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. And I suppose that there also would have been a way that medieval Japan, particularly during the long period of the Tokugawa rule, was maybe a little bit more like Europe in the sense that it was a feudal society. There were warlords of various places around the country that had independent military forces, and that there always was a central authority. It was essentially a military dictatorship, but there also was this balance of power between the central authority and then some fairly strong regional centers of power that had to be respected, and indeed it was always a challenge, I think, for the central military authority to do what it could to make sure that the warlords didn't get too big or didn't consolidate their power to challenge the central authority.
No, that's absolutely right. I think a lot of people have drawn this parallel between Japan and Europe in the sense that you had in Japan the equivalent of feudalism, so that there were constraints on centralized power by, you know, these regional warlords. And I think the trick in getting to modern democracy is to get the balance right. You have to have a strong state, and a lot of countries with warlords like Somalia have got just the warlords without the state. And if you have just a state without the warlords, you get China, which is a centralized dictatorship. And I think that, you know, modern democracy, in a sense, you know, the most fertile ground for it is when you've got a balance between the two, when you've got a state that can act competently to enforce laws, but it's also constrained by a strong society that's able to push back. That was the formula that you had in 17th century England that really gave rise to modern parliamentary institutions.
Our guest in this hour of Focus, Francis Fukuyama, we're talking about some of the ideas you'll find in his new book, The Origins of Political Order. We will talk more after a short break. This is Focus.
Support for Focus comes from Bodywork Associates, bringing precision neuromuscular massage therapy to Champaign-Urbana since 1982 with 4 area locations, including inside the ARC, the Illini Student Union, and on Windsor Road in Champaign. More information is available at bodyworkassociates.com.
This is Focus. My name's David Inge. This is our morning talk program. We're here with 10 different interviews throughout the week in the mornings. If you'd like to find out what's going on, you can go to our website, which is WILL.illinois.edu. You can see the topics for the days and weeks ahead. In the second hour today, we'll talk about the issue of dealing with invasive non-native species here in the state of Illinois. We'll have two guests, Reuben Keller from the University of Chicago, and also Glenn Sandiford, who's an environmental writer. Tomorrow, we'll have, I think, an interesting conversation. Our guest is investigative journalist Ann Jacobson. And we'll talk about her book that's all about Area 51. People have heard of this, although the federal government continues to deny it actually exists. And people have all kinds of associations between that and UFOs and aliens. She has done some research into this place, which does exist, and what really has gone on there. And we'll talk about that tomorrow morning in the 10 o'clock hour. WILL.illinois.edu, the website, if you'd like to catch up on past programs you may have missed. You can find them there and find out what we'll be doing tomorrow and beyond. In this hour of focus, our guest is Francis Fukuyama. He is the Olivier Nambolini Senior Fellow at Stanford's Freeman Spogli Institute for International Studies. Before that, he taught at the Paul Nitzer School of Advanced International Studies of Johns Hopkins University. And his new book is The Origins of Political Order from Pre-Human Times to the French Revolution, and it's published by Ferris, Strauss, and Giroux. Well, we've talked a little bit about the development of the state, a little bit about the rule of law. I want to make sure we talk about here the third leg of these three that you outline as being important features of the modern state, and that is the issue that the government, the ruler, is accountable to the people. Something that you argue really develops it begins to develop in medieval Europe, but has its real flowering in Britain in a way that it didn't happen in Europe. Yeah, talk about that.
Sure. So the idea of accountability is the idea that rulers have responsibility to this broader community. They're not just in it for themselves and their families. We, I think, sometimes have this notion that it just took the idea of equality and democracy to get going, and everybody, you know, then agreed, yes, everybody should participate. It's an idea, actually, that comes from Alexis de Tocqueville, who argues this in Democracy in America. But in fact, if you look at the history of the growth of democratic institutions, they didn't happen everywhere, and they happened only in one particular country, which was England. And in a sense, it was a kind of historical accident that you got to democracy in the first place. Every country in Europe during the Middle Ages had a feudal institution that were called estates. In England, it was the parliament. In France, it was the sovereign courts. It was the Cortes in Spain, Diet in Poland and Hungary, the Zemsky Sobor in Russia. And in each of these cases, by feudal law, the king had to go to these estates to get permission to raise taxes, to declare war, to make certain important decisions. And then, beginning in the late 16th and 17th centuries, you get a lot of European monarchs. They're very ambitious. They want to claim the whole of sovereignty over their territories. And they engage in this long-term struggle against their estates. And in every single country, except for England, it's the monarch that wins. So in France or in Spain, this long-term struggle reduces the estates to a kind of minor nuisance, whereas in England, and in England alone, the parliament manages to raise its own army. They fight the king to a standstill in a civil war. They actually behead one king, Charles I, in 1649, and then they depose a second king, James II, in 1688 in the Glorious Revolution. They bring a pretender, an alternative king over from Holland, William of Orange, and set him up as the new English monarch. And as a result of the political settlement, in the Glorious Revolution, you get established for the first time in Europe the principle of parliamentary sovereignty, that the king cannot raise taxes without going to Parliament and getting Parliament's permission, so he's accountable to Parliament. This is not really democracy at this point, because in 17th century England, Parliament only represented maybe 10% of the whole population, the wealthiest 10%. but at least the principle gets established, no taxation without representation. And from that point, it's less than 100 years to the founding of the American Republic, based on a very similar principle. John Locke, the great philosopher, participated in the Glorious Revolution. He writes the Second Treatise on Government, which says that legitimate government is really based on consent of the people, and that's, you know, that's the founding principle of democracy in the United States. And so, in a certain sense, you can see American democracy as a consequence of this accidental chain of events that allows one parliament in Europe, the English Parliament, to emerge as the sovereign body in that country.
Hmm. That, again, I think it's quite fascinating, and I'm sure when you ask this question, why one place and not someplace else, you have to acknowledge the fact that from one country to another, their conditions are going to be different. So, but one has to wonder, other countries in Europe, the rulers, the kings, had these fractious nobles that they had to answer to, and they were people that had some military force, and there always, I suppose, would have been the potential that they could have bound together like they did in England and rise up against the king. But it didn't. It didn't happen anyplace else. And that in spite of the fact that the kings on the continent had to answer to the churches, to the church, and also to their nobility, the elites in society, despite the best efforts of those people to fight the kings all won. Except,
right.
And the one exception is England. So again, one comes back to this question: well, what was it about England that made it different from France, Germany, Spain,
mm-hmm.
you know, any place else that in Europe that you would name?
Yeah, well, there were a lot of peculiarities in English development. So, for example, the common law was different from the kind of civil law tradition that existed on the continent. And one of the rallying cries for the English Parliament was defense of the common law against the king who wanted to put himself above the law. England also had a local government in a way that most continental European countries didn't. They had these things called moots and shires and hundreds that were local, you know, institutions where the leading people in the town would get together. It's kind of the origin of the New England town meeting in American practice. The other thing, you know, the other part of the explanation is that English monarchs weren't as clever as some of their contemporaries in other parts of Europe. So the French king, for example, was able to essentially buy off opposition by essentially selling parts of the public sector off to wealthy individuals. They had a practice of a venal public office in which the position of finance minister would be auctioned off in a public auction, and it would go to the highest bidder, who is always a wealthy financier who would then use his access to the public purse to enrich himself and his family. And in fact, in France, in the early 1600s, you had the institution called the Paulette, in which you could actually not only buy the office, but you could give it to your children as heritable property. So in a sense, if you think that, you know, developing countries today are corrupt, the French, in a sense, institutionalized this kind of corruption. And one of the consequences of this is that it completely undermined the solidarity of the estates or the parliaments that were standing up to the French king, because everybody had this idea, well, I've taken care of myself and my family, so you know, I don't have to worry about the, you know, anyone else. Tocqueville actually described this very beautifully. He said that the French understood liberty as privilege, and as a result, there wasn't any solidarity in trying to argue in principle that the king ought to be accountable. And that's one of the causes of the French Revolution. The system was so corrupt. The public sector was so divided among these, in effect, special interests or elite interests, that the whole system crumbled then in 1789.
We just have about 10 minutes. I want to tell people listening that we have about 10 minutes left here in this hour of Focus with Francis Fukuyama. He's at Stanford University now. His new book is The Origins of Political Order, From Prehuman Times to the French Revolution. Ferrer Strauss Giroux is the publisher. And as I explained back at the beginning of the program, it's his way of trying to answer a very large question, and that is the features of an optimally functioning state, the place with stability, prosperity, peace, as I said, the place where people want to live. These things that we've been talking about, how do they come about? Why is it that it's sort of remarkable? His observation is that it's remarkable that any place has all three of them. So the question is, well, where do they come from? And this was this book, in some detail, greater detail than we've been able to do here, tries to answer that question. So if you're interested, you can seek it out. And still, there's a, still an opportunity here if somebody wants to call in, ask a question, 333-9455, a toll-free 800-222-9455. Well, I want to, in a sense here, jump up now a little bit closer to where we are and ask some questions about what this means for us. Some people might say, well, this is really quite fascinating, but so what? What does that mean for us today? And maybe, again, go back to Asia and to have you, again, talk a little bit about, do a little comparison and contrast between the two major Asian nations now and nations that when you look around the world and you ask, well, who are the up-and-comers? Well, the two that are on the list are China and India. Now, what's interesting, though, about the two places is that we both see them as places that have this great kind of potential. They're both great nations. They have great populations. They have significant resources and significant human capital to draw on. But they have two rather different traditions that go back some way that might indeed help to answer the question, well, what really are we expecting of these countries in the future?
Well, that's right. Like every business school in the country has been teaching courses on emerging markets, and the central comparison is the China-India comparison.
Mm-hmm.
China, obviously, continuing in this long tradition, has a powerful, relatively high-quality authoritarian government, and the one thing that they know how to do is make decisions, and so they decide they're going to build the Three Gorges Dam. It requires moving 1.3 million people out of the floodplain, and so they just do it, and people really can't protest or they can't launch lawsuits. India, by contrast, is kind of the opposite. It's constantly dogged by labor unions, by peasants associations, by legal constraints on power because it's a law-governed democracy. And I think that a lot of people looking at these two countries think that this is simply the result of the experience of the last century or so. The Chinese had communism and the Indians had British colonialism that granted them handed down a tradition of democracy. But I think that if you look at the longer course of the history of these two societies, you'll see that it's absolutely not an accident that they're different in this fashion. So China really has this tradition of centralized, high-quality authoritarian government going all the way back to the 3rd century B.C. It falls apart on periodically between dynasties, but it always reforms as a centralized a coherent state. India is almost the opposite, that there's several brief periods in Indian history where they achieve unity and you know, relatively strong government, but these only last a couple of generations, and the default condition of India is to be a strong society with a weak state. And so the issue is not, as Amartya Sen has argued, that democracy itself is deeply rooted in India. What's not rooted is really dictatorship, that no Indian government has ever been able to achieve the kind of concentrated power that Chinese governments have been able to achieve. No Indian government, you know, could contemplate a big engineering project like the Great Wall simply because they couldn't concentrate that much power. So it shouldn't come as a surprise to us now that these countries are governed in very different ways.
Well, then, if you ask the question, you know, yeah, I'm sure that one could argue that the distinctive features of each could be either an advantage or a disadvantage, you know, depending on how you want to argue it, and maybe depending on what it is you're arguing about. But can you, weighing those two things, though, if you had to bet on one or the other country,
right,
which one would you bet on?
Well, you know, I think you shouldn't think about China and India. You should think about China and the United States because, in a sense, that's kind of the, you know, the big question going forward. So right now, the Chinese look pretty good. If you've been to China recently, they've got incredible infrastructure, airports, high-speed rail, highway systems, and so forth. And that's because of this authoritarian tradition that allows them to make complex macroeconomic policy decisions and to do it fairly well. If you think about our system, we have these three sets of institutions. We've got a state that's powerful, but it's checked by law and it's checked by democratic accountability. And right now, at least in the short run, we can't make decisions. You know, we the United States are faced with these long-term problems of deficit and fiscal sustainability. There is actually a path forward, but the political system right now is so checked and balanced that it can't actually get past the short-term obstacles to make these decisions. And so, you know, in a certain sense, the Chinese system seems, you know, to leap over all of the problems of creating democratic consensus and getting past entrenched interest groups and the like. I think, however, that the longer-term question is going forward into the next generation, which of these systems, the unchecked authoritarian one or the democratic one with all these checks and balances, which one of these is going to be the more sustainable? And I would still vote with our system because there's one problem that the Chinese have never been able to solve, which is the problem they call the problem of the bad emperor. An authoritarian system, if it's benevolent, if it's high quality, can actually run rings around a democratic system in the short run. But how do you guarantee that you're always going to have a good emperor in charge? And the Chinese in their history have had a lot of bad emperors. I think the last one that they would commonly concede was pretty terrible was Mao Zedong. And so in a sense, democracy with all of its slowness and inefficiencies and so forth at least puts a floor under bad government that if you don't like a president, you can always vote him out of office and you could put an alternative in place. And that, I think, is going to be the long-run advantage of a system that has the balance between state, rule of law, and accountable government.
We have a caller here. I want to try to get him in the time that remains. We'll go to them in Urbana, line number one. Hello.
Hi. Very quickly, I haven't heard you address the middle class as a bulwark against on a stable democracy. I know we only have a minute, but I'd like to address that. I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you.
Well, if you define middle class as people that actually own some property that can be taken away from them by the government, I think it's very important in that story I told about 17th century England, the people represented in Parliament were actually the country's property owners, and they didn't want to be taxed without having a say in how that tax money would be used. And I think that it's true in general that that's really the basis of democracy in the modern world. If you do have a middle class that has assets that can be taken by the government, they've got a very powerful interest in making that government accountable. One problem in a lot of developing countries that have oil or diamonds or some other natural resource that just comes out of the ground without very much effort, you don't have to go to taxpayers, and therefore you don't need accountability. And that's one of the reasons I think that you see in oil-rich or resource-rich states very weak democratic institutions.
Just as a way of finishing up, we have about a minute or so. I think that probably a lot of people will recognize your name and will remember what had been written and said about one of your previous books, The End of History and The Last Man, and in which you, and again here I'm simplifying a complicated argument, made this argument that the modern Western liberal democratic state, the United States, for example, or I think one place that you often cite as an example, interestingly enough, is Denmark, that as far as the evolution of forms of government goes, that's the end point. Is that something you still? And again, forgive me because I know I'm vastly oversimplifying. Is that still something? Still an argument that you're making?
Well, I think that you have to understand what the argument was. The question is there a higher evolutionary form of government that we are on our way to? A lot of people in the past 100 years thought that it was communism, and that ended, that dream ended in 1989. And I would say that it's still the case that I don't really see a higher political system that's out there. I don't think that anyone really wants to live under a Chinese-style dictatorship. I certainly don't think that many people around the world want to live in a in an Islamic republic like Iran under the rule of a bunch of mullahs. And so I do think that liberal democracy really is the default form of government. And until someone points the way to a political system that really offers people, you know, greater respect for their dignity as well as serving as the basis for, you know, a prosperous modern society, you know, I think that we're kind of there at this end point.
Well, we are at the end point. We're going to have to stop. For people who want to read more in greater depth from our guest, you should look at his new book. The title is The Origins of Political Order, From Pre-Human Times to the French Revolution. Ferris Strauss Giroux is the publisher. Our guest, Francis Fukuyama, he's senior fellow at Stanford University's Freeman Spogli Institute for International Studies. And Dr. Fukuyama, thank you very much.
Thank you.